Hello, hello, this is Kinnack, coming back to you for a special about-to-go-to-Japan edition of the Metroplexity podcast. We don't have a ton of questions, but I'm just going to more or less jump into it, and if there's anything at the end that I'm thinking about that I haven't answered yet, I will jump in there and do that. Fair warning, I'm literally going to be going to Japan tomorrow in a little more than 24 hours, I guess. I'll be getting on our first of several planes. So I'm trying to convince my body that it's 5:30 p.m. rather than 4:30 a.m., which is a little bit past even my normal bedtime. So if I am incoherent in any way or just, like, space out for, like, 5 minutes in the middle of the podcast or something, that's all that's going on there. Nothing terrible is happening. I'm just sort of trying to pre-jet lag myself so that hopefully I can hit the ground running. All right, first off, we've got a bunch of questions from Cryptodynamic. Hey, can I, as of this writing, I just hit a few... Just a few days ago, hit my 8th anniversary with Metroplexity, so here's looking forward to another good year. Absolutely, I think we've gotten some pretty cool stuff out this year. Sort of got my feet back under me as far as that goes, so we should be seeing some, obviously, not a ton of stuff for the next month, with the whole being in Japan thing, but after that we've got some cool stuff planned, which your other questions might speak to. How are things going to the trip to Japan? I think it might be a good time for me to work in getting a closed system run. That's not a bad idea. I obviously just released a donation on yesterday, and will not be releasing another one until probably a ways after we... Well, I guess... It's worth getting a little bit into plans. I don't think anyone's planning on seeing me in Japan, other than Midi out of Puyo's friends, which is pretty funny. The reactions are from... We have a very good friend of hers who's actually come out here to visit, who's just, you know, excited to see us, and is meeting us at the airport because she's awesome and all of this, to the, like... Oh, you know, you've got geeky gaijin friends. Great, I'll meet you in Akiba, or Akihabara, whichever, if you want to use the full name or not. And, you know, help show them around, which is also awesome, to the, like, I haven't actually met, you know, gaijin before. And, like, what the fuck? How do I deal with that? Which is pretty cool. And hopefully we will not scar anyone for life or, you know, give them, I guess I was going to say, give them the wrong impression, about our country, but whether, the impression they get off of us is the wrong one is definitely a, matter of some contention at the moment. Yeah, we'll be out there for about 3 weeks, going to Tokyo, a little town in Fukushima province by the name of Shirakawa. Let's see, Kyoto and Nara, which is sort of like, I feel like is part of Kyoto, but I think is... technically actually different. It might actually be some ways. It's traveling in Japan is a very it gives a very interesting perspective on distances, because, like, being used to the US, Japan is not, you know, a particularly large country, again compared to the US, but it's just the way it's put together between, I mean, obviously, a lot of mountains, not necessarily, and, you know, there's several islands going on, so it's not necessarily easy to get from place to place, but at the same time, if you can, like, there's a train line that's actually going from the place you are to the place you're going. You will get there very fast. So, the actual, like, mile or kilometer, to be remotely useful, distances involved are largely irrelevant, which I find kind of interesting. So we'll get to play around with that some. So yeah, Kyoto, Hiroshima, Kagoshima, which is a city further down south near a fairly active volcano, so we'll get to see some volcanism at work, and I would say it's some nonsense, but there's some there will probably be a number of onsens being hit between the whole process. And then back to Tokyo. Oh, I was like, damn it, I know I forgot one. We'll also be stopping in Osaka. And Puyo will be with us for basically all of that. We're sort of like the little town up in Fukushima is where Puyo's favorite, like, local hero is from, Dariser. And we're gonna get to go on a tour of the town that he actually does, apparently in character. Like, I knew that she got in touch with the guy and was like, hey, can we get a tour? And it's like, oh, like, we're gonna get to, you know, meet the guy who's, like, you know, organizes the local, this local hero thing, which is a really just cool phenomenon in general. It's like, no. No, he's actually gonna be, like, apparently, like, in costume and in character, and the whole thing is themed after a board game, which is great, because, like, his villains in character are actually, like, they're dice-themed. Like, they have these really fucking sweet-looking masks that have basically pips on them for the number of a person, but they end up looking very, very intimidating. Or at least, like, inhuman. Like, just because of the styling of the masks. That he did. I think he's the one who did the costume design, but whoever did the costume design did a fucking awesome job. But yeah, and then Osaka, she's got some family down there, and basically everywhere we're going, she has friends, because she insists that she's not a social person, but she seems to have a rather wide network of friends who want to see her when we're passing through. So I guess we'll just have to let the science answer that one. Let's see. Oh, but yeah, so we're doing all of that. That's going to be awesome, and I will be I will have electronic devices which will hopefully allow me to at least keep up nominally with bug reports and stuff like that. I would not expect a lot beyond that, though. Very much like when I went to Australia a number of years ago. So then we'll be coming home for, like, 3 days, and then turning around and going out to Seattle for PaizoCon. So that's going to be kind of an intense turnaround, and hopefully I will not have completely mangled my understanding of the English language while we're out there. I've definitely found that some of our previous travels have resulted in short-circuiting my languages into sort of like a... I don't pick up languages terribly well, but we'll start to sort of integrate words and phrases without realizing it, which definitely is not the way you want to do that. So I may or may not be able to, you know, speak understandable English when we get there. Which isn't to say that I'll be speaking Japanese, just like about half of it will be, you know, sort of half-assed, bad, not even Japanese. Anyway, moral of the story, we're going out to Seattle for like a week and a half, and during that, I should have, that's more of a working vacation. The actual days of PaizoCon, I don't really know exactly what we're going to be doing. Liz is going to be seeing her coworkers, and how much of that I'm invited around with at all, or whatever. That's not a... that's all sort of up in the air. So, and then we'll be coming back to Columbus, and I'll be full bore on everything, and hopefully recharged and kicking ass. So yeah, if anybody's if anybody's hanging out in Japan that I don't know about, definitely give me a holler. We are planning on sort of, you know, wandering and seeing people as part of the process. But see above about sleep cycle changing. But there's also Seattle, if anybody's up there. On to the actual questions. Will the Phoenix be where we eventually learn to cook, assuming our taste buds survive the experience? Some of the stuff from the Phoenix will probably end up being useful in cooking, like that's sort of the intent. But the main cookery is actually on, by cookery I mean where you'll be able to get an oven to put in your apartment, will be in the surface of downtown. Do you think the proprietors of the Phoenix would take out Happy Dragon delivery drones? Probably not. They have a bit of a different sideline already, which there are actually some pretty subtle hints about in the game already, but will become more readily apparent when cellar door opens. In the picture of Discount CyberDoc, are the things behind him specialized cyber limbs? Is it possible for cyberware in this setting to provide functional limbs that are in addition to the normal ones, not just replacements? They are, and yes. Generally speaking, they're better for sort of decorative purposes. It takes a lot of training. I mean, there's sort of, when you're dealing with sort of the normal set of limbs, there's some, you know, neural infrastructure, especially if you're talking about a replacement limb for something that was lost relatively recently, that you can just sort of, like, basically hook things into, and I mean, it takes a little bit of, this is even speaking, like, with extremely near-future technology, not even Metroplex-level technology. You know, you can get things trained up pretty quickly. But, if you're talking about, giving someone a new limb that they never had, like if they were just born without arms or something like that, that's a more complicated training process, but definitely doable. And going the next step with what you're seeing with the CyberDoc, it requires both, like, that level of training that, like, you know, you're adding a new arm, but also you're sort of, like, it requires an additional compartmentalization, because, you know, you're sort of choosing which arm to reach out with, and doing a lot of additional things with body mapping that you'd normally, just adding a layer of complexity there, I guess, that you don't normally have. So, they're not, without a lot of training, they're not typically great, but they do definitely get used both as decorative components and as actual utility in some cases. Like, it wouldn't be... It would be weird to see, like, an office worker with them, like, for better filing or something like that. But when you start to get into more, like, actual heavy labor tasks, which, admittedly, to a large extent, have switched over to drones in Metroplex City. In Metroplex, specifically, is actually what I meant to say there. Because of Midgard's presence, obviously, you will start to see, yeah, like, you know, if someone were doing actual mining rather than having a drone do it, and there are some places in the world where that would happen, getting a couple of extra cyber limbs might actually be extremely useful. You might also see that in, like, Cyber Bowl, places like that. Any hints on what might be the next list to open up in downtown? That would definitely be a cellar door. That will not be happening while I am out of the country, unfortunately. That'll be the next big thing that I'm working on, though. Halloween's up down somewhere downtown this year, perhaps? That seems likely enough, yeah. Yeah, as far as sort of the status of downtown, the last couple of weeks have been rough, not just because I'm, you know, prepping to go to Japan, getting all of that squared away, and onboarding a big, new project, which, you can read about on the dev blog if you want. I'm working with, some third-party Pathfinder folks to develop a line of sort of Lovecraftian horror products for them called Shadows Over Gothic. That'll be really fun, but that hasn't eaten into the time for Metroplexity, which is good. It's actually, I think we're getting... With that, well, with the onboarding for that, like, I was sort of hitting I was starting to hit, with Twilight Heroes, Metroplexity, and then the onboarding for that was starting to hit the actual, like, time, as being a constraint. But I think with that, and there was a book that I was writing, also for a different Pathfinder third party. So with all of that, it was like, oh, time! Time is actually a thing. It's not, you know, purely based on sort of, like, energy, so to speak. But with the onboarding process sort of over, that's shifted back out, and it's like, oh, okay, we're back to just entirely energy now. But anyway, over the past few weeks, it's been, it's like, okay, you know, I really want to get Solid Door out and an Unearthly Item out before I go to Japan. So I started working on the Unearthly Item, started well, not started, kept working on the Unearthed Atom that I've been working on for, you know, months at this point, on and off, sporadically. Which goes back to the energy rather than time constraint. If I could just, you know, plopped 20 hours into it, it would have been well and done by now. But chucked away on that for a bit, and that just sort of didn't gel at all. And so that actually got sort of went through a drastic reimagining that I might talk about more later if any questions. I guess all of the questions were written before I released the donation, so I'll just talk about it. So it got sort of, it was one item that between just like size creep and the original size of the plan. I mean, the original size of the plan was probably like pretty easily a 3-coin item, and then it just sort of kept growing and growing and growing. And so what's probably going to happen with that, I released Dusty Clipboard yesterday, and what is probably going to happen is that the next coming up out, there may actually be other donation items that sort of hook into it, like they aren't required to interact with each other, but actually do have direct interactions, to sort of tell that whole story, basically. And some mechanical effects, but not like, oh, you know, if you, you know, you can't really use, you know, the last one if you don't have the first one or anything like that, but there's a pretty substantial narrative arc, I guess, that goes through that, and putting it all in one item with all of the mechanical stuff that's attached to all of that narrative, it would have been like a 6-7 coin item, something like that. And it's like, that's just, no, like, we need to take a step back and not do that. Not be a complete crazy person. So there's a lot of work that's actually kind of on another chunk of the story, that the Dusty Clipboard's attached to. So that's a thing. Hopefully that all comes together. But the other that sort of disrupted cellar door work. So hopefully that'll also be picking back up as I drop in with both in Seattle and when I get back home. And hopefully that gets back on track. I'm really actually super excited about Cellar Door. Cellar Door is one of the very first places in Metroplex that got created in the original design documents. Like, I think like as far as like visitable zones go, I think it's the second one. Like, I think there's sort of like the quad cellar door, another thing that you won't be getting to for a while, and then sort of going back and filling in. I mean, basically, like, the entire game. So, yeah, it's something that I've been looking forward to for a bit, and I've got some great art from Puyo. Oh, my God. It's just I mean, Puyo does good work and has done better and better work as we've been going, but some of the stuff I got back for Solid are really, really knocked it out of the park. I'm very excited to show some of it off. Anyway, is the Mite Carapace from Calling Mites a really rare drop? So they're triggered to get it, other than the sampling kit. It is... There is some... It sounds like there's something that isn't... You may not be quite 100% on, like, understanding what's going on, but it's basically, like, even if you did understand that, it's basically just rare. Like, there's not, like, a special dance or anything that you have to do. It just doesn't come up very much. With the main questline completed in Old Town, do you think we'll get a special intro for the first time taking the metros there, like the older zones? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should have actually put that in quite a while ago. Let me... Gonna schedule a reminder for myself about this in for when I get back. Okay. Great. Because I need to, among other things, actually get art for it. That's the main hang up. How are things looking for the next Unearthly Atom? Ah, see, I should have totally waited for my giant ramble about the Unearthly Atom until now. Is any of the stuff the guy who rants on public access TV talks about actually just crazy conspiracy theories? We've been able to map a lot of his topics to real things, but there's some stuff that we don't seem to have seen in-game yet. There is a bit of a question there of... What's... Sort of a bit of a cause and effect, like what things... he talks about because they're out there, and what things... are out there just because people believe in them. I mean, the sort of thing like even setting aside the effects of that eclipse might have on this, you know, you start talking about rogue AIs, like we've really been expecting rogue AIs any day now for, you know, God, better part of 50 years? Maybe longer. Maybe almost 70? I'd have to figure out the exact dates. Decades now. And they still haven't had a proper robopocalypse, even in Metroplex D's timeline. So, if someone eventually did, like, it would make him look maybe a little less crazy, but at the same time, like, you have to think we've been, you know, planning for this code to turn on us for 100 years, like, at some point you have to wonder if we made it turn on us just to stop feeling like we're quite so, you know, alarmist about it. Or, you know, maybe it got out onto the net, is reading about how, you know, all the AIs turn against us and just figured that that's what it was supposed to do. Which I'm sure is also a story that's been told dozens of times over the decades, which really. It's when sci-fi starts to get delightfully meta. What exactly is My Little Idoru? There's clearly a lot of toys, at least one TV show, and it seems to have a decent fan base, but we've only seen the edge of it. Actually, we're seeing a little bit more of that downtown, but I see it as very contiguous to something like Idolmaster, or even more specifically, I think it's Cinderella Girls is the name of it. Let me check really quick. Don't want to, you know, reference the wrong... No, Cinderella Girls is the anime? No. Great. No, I was right. Okay. I would hate to give you the wrong information about Idolmaster, but it's sort of like it's sort of like imaginary American Idol. If that doesn't make any more sense for anyone who isn't actually familiar with Idolmaster. So it'll be like Zaibatsu, obviously, is the company that runs that whole program. They will have basically a roster of synthetic idols created through computer wizardry. I mean, very much like simulated, intentionally animated, not, you know, fully human looking, trying to stay on the far side of the uncanny valley. And the actual performers, if they even, you know, bother to have those, will be, you know, back sort of behind the mask, as it were. I mean, doing voice work, you know, rather than coming out and being the actual, you know, the star themselves. And then probably a lot of things like, you know, having contests to determine, you know, which idol will, like, get advanced to the next round and get new toys, and how do you determine which one advances? Well, you know, maybe voting nominally, but really, like, buying products for them. And, like, oh, you know, you want your idol to get advanced to the next round so you can get, you know, the sweet new toy with her with, like, the little guitar or whatever. Well, you know, you buy her track, and that, you know, every track that gets bought gets counted for her, you know, great, go home. And that's, like, how, I'm sure, 99% of people interact with it. But then you have the 1% of people who interact with it by getting really obsessed with one person and buying, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of their tracks so that, you know, the quote, right person advances to the next round and they can get, you know, the figurine they want. All of which is basically just things that are already pretty normal in Japan. The a little mushed together, but you've got like Cinderella Girls, which I mentioned before, is actually a mobile game that's based on that, with like the sort of horrifically abusive, you know, you're sort of like basically cracking packs or playing Gachapon if you're familiar, to, you know, try and get the correct version of the correct idol to, you know, go and defeat the other idols with the power of music and what have you. The other idols in this case actually being like characters controlled by other people in the game, other players. So there's sort of like a PvP element. So, you know, you're both trying to get, but then like the more popular idols also get like special versions of them released, which you also want to collect if you're into that idol land, you know. If there's like one that you particularly like, I'm not aware of in Cinderella Girls them using the direct payment feedback loop. That's something that happens elsewhere with like CD sales and AKB 40 something, AKB 48, there we go. Yeah, great. Yeah, so there's a lot of just like the third sort of layer is the normal Idol Master games, like Cinderella Girls, sort of the mobile game, sort of abusive part of it. The normal Idol Master games are console games where you're in some ways kind of creepily, a little bit maybe, depending on how you play through things. You're basically a manager for a bunch of idols, and you're trying to, you know, make them successful in the game world. And you can, like, I guess this gets back to abuse. Like, you can buy, like, DLC, basically. I mean, not, like, the Cinderella Girl stuff is, I can't even scratch the surface of how intensely that game like grabs into certain people. But the console ones, you know, you're buying tracks which are actually performed by humans, but are in the context of the game being performed by characters in the game, and for most of the people, like, the character is the primary sort of actress, which is where you get into, I mean, there's obviously the, you know, Hatsune Miku, people like that, quote, people like that, which are, like, fully synthetic stars, but you can also, like, really create a hybrid, which lets you, I mean, sort of, like, think, like, there are some cartoon characters we have strong associations with individual voice actors, like the genie from Aladdin. Not just saying that because Robin really died and it's all sad and everything. Although it is, because he was, I mean, did a great job with basically everything that he worked on. But, like, that's a character that's very, like, very associated with that actor. But at the same time, also within, like, the Disney sphere, you have, like, Mickey Mouse, right? And nobody could be like, oh, yeah, like, I know who. I mean, I'm sure somebody out there knows who, off the top of their head, who voice acts Mickey Mouse in different places. But, just thinking about, you know, for the vast majority of people, you can take, you know, out the voice actor for a given character and put in someone who either sounds similar enough or, in some cases, sounds different in the way that you want the character to be different. And actually just have that work out. Which, among other things, means that you don't actually have to pay the people as much. Which is a whole set of problems. There's a lot of, it really deprioritizes the individual and lets you sort of slot people out very easily. Which is a whole other layer. I guess that's the third layer that I was talking about there. So yeah, it's just it's American My Little Adora is American Idol, but all of the actual people are fake. Like the people that you are watching, the visuals are flim-flammery animation, right? Or razzle-dazzle, as it were. And instead of just being call in, it's actually very much based on direct feedback for money. Which is to say, it actually works very much like a normal, studio or whatever, except that everything is open in the most, sort of abusive way possible. It's like, oh, your favorite band is going to have a new CD if they sell, a million copies of their existing CD. And for a lot of people, it's like, okay, I'll buy the current CD and I hope they get a million copies of the new CD. But then for some people, they're like, okay, I'll buy copies of this for all my friends, or everybody who's getting a copy of this for Christmas. Okay, well, that's starting to sound pretty good. And then you sort of say, well, your favorite band will get a new CD if they sell more than this other band in a genre that's approximately as popular, but that you don't like. This is sort of your heavy metal band will do will get a new CD as long as they sell more of their current CD than the bubblegum pop band, the next group over. With the sort of Adore structure being that it's actually individuals rather than entire bands, but your metal singer versus your bubblegum pop singer, and just sort of, I think you can maybe start to get some idea of how intense people might start to get about that, and really trying to okay, so I gave everybody copy of, my favorite idols, Christmas release, that guy over there gave everybody his Christmas release. Oh, and he gave them to all of these people at work too. I guess I'd better, sort of keep up with the Joneses, and then eventually, and this is not actually, this part of it is not actually a joke. There are people in Japan now who will get, dozens or hundreds of copies of some of the CDs for groups for groups that use this sort of mechanic already, and, like, not even, like, give them away. And sometimes they'll have, like, raffle tickets associated with them or stuff, that, so that, like, it's not purely wasted, or looking to, from another lens, there's some sort of additional mechanic to draw people in even deeper. So yeah, moral of the story, it's a really fun program, a lot of people like, because it showcases a lot of different sort of music, and, like, has sort of, you know, this engaging sort of storyline, but it's also, like, really abusive to basically everyone involved in it. When you start to get into it more, I'll try and include a little bit of the thoughts of people like the university students and the like, who have some pretty strong opinions, both because there's, you know, a lot of musical opinions involved, which people can get very intense about, but also some of them aren't fans of the process, which doesn't necessarily stop them from being involved. Anyway, speaking of music, saw a great concert with my spouse earlier today. That was amazing. With her early music group. Okay. Alright. Next question. I'm trying to draw people into the game, but often running into issues with the first hurdle, telling people the game actually is. How would you describe Metroplexia to a potential new player who may not have played similar games like Kingdom of Loathing or Twilight Heroes? It depends a bit sort of where the conversation is coming from. I end up talking about the game a lot when people are like, well, what do you do? It's like, well, I describe it as basically a text-based story game with a lot of with combat elements, but also, you know, you can solve everything completely non-violently. But a lot of times, you know, coming from, you know, what sort of setting is it? You know, we're talking about some retrofuturism or cyberpunk, or, you know, wow, everything looks kind of dystopian right now, and talking about dystopian fiction, and then it'll be sort of the, it's like, well, you know, it's a game set in a dark near future sort of cyberpunk setting with undercurrents of a lot of things you expect like that, with the corporate corruption and subversion of, you know, human rights and sort of the development of technology and how that's impacted people, but also some more fantastic elements under the surface, and how the corporations and the people in that world sort of end up interacting with that. And there was a third. Let's see, what do you do? Talking about settings. Oh, the other time that it comes up a lot is when I'm talking to people about role-playing games, because I talk to people about role-playing games all the time, too, because I'm also very passionate about that. As far as that goes, I mean, I really sort of started doing Metroplexity because I can't GM for everyone. and I wanted there to be more places where you can sort of get an experience like a good tabletop RPG without needing a GM, basically. Sort of automated experience. And there's obviously a lot of limitations there, but there's also, you know, we've created this expansive world, a lot of options in it, that is also very deeply interconnected, so that there's always these things to discover, and you can really go off in very interesting directions that may not have been, you know, entirely intended and thought out. Obviously, the difference between doing this in tabletop and doing it in Metroplexity is when you run into something that you wish that you could do that you can't do. In a tabletop game, you just try to do it, and the GM's like, oh yeah, you can totally do it. And in Metroplexity, you have to be like, hey, we should totally be able to do this. And I'm like, shit, you should totally be able to do that. And then I code it in. So it's very much, in that case, similarly to an actual tabletop RPG game, a very collaborative sort of process where you get, I mean, not only my best ideas, but the ideas of, you know, all of the players that have come before you, which I think is an incredibly powerful tool to create a really sort of complex, layered living experience. So, yeah, that's the sort of stuff that I usually talk about. As I said, a little sleepy, so that's probably a little less coherent than I would have pitched it in most cases, but I really always blow it out from one point in the conversation more than having a standardized pitch. But hopefully that'll work for you, and you can get some folks interested. Always welcome to have some new voices. I'm interested in your thoughts on daily tasks in games like this. We've got some, like using a personal tree or getting red flags or personal serum, but I find in Kingdom of Logan that there are so many tasks to do daily that even if chatmakers to cover a lot of it, I find it is frequently too much hassle to bother. I don't like... And the personal tree is on the edge of this. What I don't like with those is if they don't have cost associated with them. And it might sound a little weird, but it's just, it ends up being to be optimal, you need to do this laundry list of things. Whereas if, you know, once a day you can trade even a pittance, like you can trade an energy, right, for cool thing X. Well, okay. Like, that might be great. And maybe even to be optimal, you would do it every day. Like, maybe it is always better than an energy. Probably not. Like, I don't think that there's a... I don't think that that's necessarily something that you can say across the board, but I feel that it's very different opting out of paying that cost as opposed to just opting out of, like, clicking the link, right? It's like, if you opt out of paying the cost, you've got this extra energy, you can use that energy to do whatever you want, right? But if you don't click that link, like, you really just don't click that link. And that I think is a difference that can seem insignificant, but ends up being pretty relevant. And you also have things like personal tree that are a little on the edge of that, like I said, where the real cost for that one is sort of the equipment spot it's taking up and things like that. So that's a little more passive than maybe I'd even like, but I think that in general it is something you have to be careful about with giving things away for free, if that makes sense. Like, it seems like it should be good, and I think that because it seems like it should be good, it's a very tempting design space, particularly for stuff like Items of the Month, Cane of Loathing, or Unearthly Items Here, where, you know, oh, get a cool thing every day. Rock on, right? Like, sweet. And maybe it's a little less exciting to say, like, okay, you know, use this item instead of this other item in this slot and spend a couple energy to get a cool thing every day. Yeah, it's less punchy, right? Like, there's less immediate gratification. And, I mean, sometimes you screw up, right? And there isn't an appropriate cost associated with it or whatever. That's a separate issue. And I think I don't think that there's any real profit motive even with that, associated with Kingdom Loathing. But even if there were, like, I really think that, like, being like, oh, yeah, if people are excited about this, we'll give them what they're excited about, and, like, they'll give us money, and we'll keep the game running. Like, I don't even really want to call it a trap you can fall into, because, like, that's really, like, it seems very all-win, and I think that to a large extent it is, but then, I mean, you do eventually reach a point where those things start to weigh you down, and that point is different for each player, by which I mean, like, you know, you might be okay doing getting half a dozen free things every day, clicking on half a dozen things to get the free stuff. Another person might not want to do it once. Another person might be able to do it 20 times. And so, as a designer, it's not even necessarily like, you know, don't do this. It's just, you have to do it very carefully. But I think, by and large, you can avoid the worst of that by attaching actual costs. So, lots of thoughts there. Hopefully I answered your question. Hey, Akinek! Sorry, this is from Al. As of this writing, and just a few days ago hit my 8th anniversary with Metroplexity, so looking forward to another good year. I'm not sure if you... Well, I mean, Al has also been around for the appropriate length of time. The fact that they started off with the same line is a little weird, but not inaccurate. How are things looking for the trip to Seattle? I'm thinking that might be good time for me to work on getting a true immortal run. Okay, all right. I think you're just making fun of me now. Okay, or making fun of each other. I think that would be a great time to work on a true immortal run. Not necessarily just Seattle. I would start that out more on the Japan side, because I will probably be at least doing a little bit of stuff in Seattle. Game-related questions. How much control does Midgard have over basic utilities of Metroplex? How hard would it be to get Eclipse into the general water supply? Midgard could very easily do that, assuming, you know, they have the appropriate amount of Eclipse on hand and things like that. If they wanted to, poison the entire city or whatever, they could absolutely do that. Which brings over to the question of, they haven't, which means either they don't have enough Eclipse, which seems possible, but possibly unlikely also. They do seem to have quite a lot of Eclipse. Or they don't want to for some reason. Probably not, because they're just such nice people. How self-contained will the downtown quest be? Will we have to wander back to old areas to complete it? Is this the end of the main quest line? It is... There are little strands of it out in other areas, but generally it's all downtown through that arc. So not like the Survivor's Quest, very much more like Old Town, I guess the University Quest isn't necessarily a great example, because you do actually go back to Southside during that. Or like the Docks Quest. So you might visit outside a little bit, but it's mostly inside there. It is not quite the end of the main quest line. There's one or two stages left. It is probably the biggest remaining chunk, though. A lot of stuff. A lot of moving parts in downtown. A lot of the other thing is a new mechanical trigger that hasn't been used elsewhere. Is there anything that depends on ascending versus descending chains other than the lines focused on unknown techniques? I don't believe so. Is there anything that checks chain position other than the sudden adaptation from the Harvest Dreams? This isn't going to, blow your mind or anything, but obviously the opener techniques, a bunch of stealth techniques and stuff, depend on that, which is sort of the flip side of sudden adaptation. Other than that, there's not a lot that depends on the absolute positioning of a technique, only the relative positioning to the rest of the chain. Not enoughly, but is there anything that checks the positioning of the opponents other than leaping flying? That actually should, at some point, and I've been planning to do this forever, so it might not happen for years, so don't take this as when I get back to Seattle or something. I'm planning on recoding area of effect attacks so that they actually are area of effect and not just the whole enemy group, so you're actually basically the target and the adjacent targets, or for a particularly larger one, the target, the adjacent targets, and the ones adjacent to them, or whatever. And among other things, that would there's a whole bunch of stuff that needs to change with area of effect attacks. They're just sort of dumb right now on the code side, not entirely on the actual function in game. I don't think, oh, they're so broken, they need to be nerfed. No. Some of the stuff that I'm doing will reduce their power, but just sort of make them make more sense and work better. So there should be some more things to do that. There aren't currently a ton. There's some some interesting stuff that goes on relative to targeting and things like that. The wings from the downtown Cyberkillie are awesome, which makes me wonder, will we ever be able to fly? I would not be surprised if you eventually got that ability. As far as I can tell, only the basic punch counts for unlocking pugilism. Would it be reasonable for all barehanded techniques to work there? Crushing punch, brick punch, jab, etc. They generally, for those sorts of things, it is really one technique that ends up carrying the burden, as it were, of learning. And I don't think that that's necessarily inappropriate. I also... don't want to start spreading that out and give people the wrong idea as it relates to figuring out other things, if that makes sense. Any hints at more title unlocks? Are there titles to find other than the seasonal and conduct-related stuff? Man, it sounds weird because I coded them actually relatively frequently, but I don't... So, like, I definitely had some ideas for once that were pretty weird. One or more might have snuck in there. But I don't think they did. So I guess we'll see. Eclipse seems to rarely affect hacking, even when hacking the shipping drone flying eye network. But we can infect the burrowing drone, turn it into a hack more. Any hints about what's going on there? Actually, I believe that there is a fairly substantial hint in the game, like in the code itself. But there's definitely a... I mean, the hint in the game is sort of a blinking sign for the right question, as it were. It sort of gives you the answer. I guess, yeah, it short-circuits you up the chain of questions. You know, it gives you an answer and then a new question. That would be the way to put that. I think that with even without that, you could probably put together what's going on there. But there's a very specific in-world thing that's going on that you just have to sort of lay the pieces in the row. I spent a week trying to hack the security hub on Backbone Relay sites. It seems to be expecting Novo system updates, but it still thinks I'm an intruder even when I have control of the Backbone. Is there a trick that we're missing or a bug? Ooh, let me actually pull that code up here. There's definitely some tricky stuff in the code there. So I don't want to tell you all the lies. Or, you know, all the truths. That's also not great. Okay. Yeah, no, you definitely can do that. Just to say it's necessarily easy. By which, of course, I mean, dear sweet God, that's hard. Or, well, to guess to be more accurate, the difficulty varies based on some other factors and can go from, even if you know what you're doing, from not too bad, or actually almost like trivially easy, to dear sweet God hard. But at least, I mean, just glancing at the code, it doesn't look bugged. And yeah, even if you'll still get that message even if you have control of the backbone. That's just the like, that's the failure message, basically. Security Hub seems to disappear sometimes on the south side hub only. Is that related to player actions or something else? There's no... I would actually be more concerned if you were seeing it on the south side relay. If you do, let me know. But you shouldn't be. Because it's not there. It is on the other relays. That's sort of, obviously, the relays are all slightly different, and that's pretty important difference for the south side one, so hopefully it is successfully not there. Blast from the past. Do the Eurasian reporter, waterlogged hand cannon, have anything more going on than meets the eye? I mean, obviously the waterlogged hand cannon is part of sort of the quest chain there. But other than that, it's not a terribly. I don't think either of them have anything terribly deep going on. The anniversary pocket mirror seems to give an extra bonus to the sword hilt weapon. Almost no other items enhanced like this. Is that an oddity of the anniversary mirror or the sword hilt? I mean, the sword hilt has a number of special interactions, but that's not... That's more of a question of how the sword hilt is seen rather than like a magic that it has about it or anything like that. And the pocket mirror kind of plays into that. Has the static TV been updated recently? I couldn't find any message from any of the newer skills, although it seems intentional that not every skill has a message. It is intentional that not every skill has a message. That is entirely correct. It hasn't been updated super recently. Let me... there might be some... that it might be worth adding. Yeah, there's definitely some of the more recent ones that just need to have effects added. added to my to-dos. Glittering eco fuel just seems to be straight up worse than smoking eco fuel. Is there something more to that one? Well, I mean, one of them is filled with glitter. Clearly. Looking into hidden categories, is there any way to cure blurred eyes? Like other cyberware-related effects, it just does not seem to be cured by means other than installing new eyes. Yeah, that's probably fair. I don't think I could probably put it in its own category that's cured by certain things, but the category that it's in now shouldn't be cured, so I have to break that out. It wouldn't entirely surprise me if there were some other way to cure it that just hasn't come up. Nope, doesn't look like it. Or at least, in my 10 seconds of searching, I did not find one. The panacea pill is the only known cure for some effects. Dark smoke, the jitters, chest wound, parasitic vine. Do these belong to a negative effect category, or are there other ways of curing those? I think that those are in a couple of different categories. The panacea pill, as I'm sure you've noticed, just covers, like, God, I don't know, something like 20 different categories or something like that. At least a dozen, let's say. And so some of those are in the same categories. Some of those are in different categories. But just because something is in a category doesn't mean there's a curative for it. I mean, particularly, and other than the panacea pill. So I'm not sure if that actually helps. But there always can be new ones. The jitters is actually probably the one that I'd be most surprised to find a new one for, but there are a lot of options. The Doctor Smith's technique enhances knife throw, but only seems to be available to NPCs. Is there any way to learn it, or any other gas-based techniques that chain with nitro? I don't believe so offhand. Yeah, it just looks like it's that one. And it wouldn't surprise me if you eventually were able to learn it or ran into techniques that other techniques that chain into nitro. But at the moment, I don't think that one is learnable. I'm pretty sure that it doesn't have an image, which is usually what but would makes all the difference for humanoid ones, humanoid techniques. It's like, oh yeah, if there were an image for that, I'd probably just stick in a way to make it learnable. But at the present, I don't believe it does. So I think that brings us to the end of our podcast. We just had a Crypto and Owl there, but you would probably not have guessed it by the fact that I've been rambling for almost an hour and a half. As it turns out, it's getting to be right about 6 a.m. here, or as I like to call it, ...7 p.m. Sounds like a totally acceptable time to go to sleep, 7 p.m.? Not really, but I think I'm going to do it anyway. Work on the rest of my jet lag when I actually am jetted places. I hope everyone has a great month while I'm out, as I at least hope I implied. I will be trying to keep on top of bug reports and the like, but the meat and potatoes of development won't start back up until later in the month when I'm back in the States. But once I do, looking at more unearthly items, naturally, and cellar door. Following cellar door, probably the surface of downtown, and then some places there. And there's some pretty cool stuff up on the surface, including, of course, Midgard Tower, Midgard headquarters, technically, the target of the downtown quest. But we've got long road ahead of us, even if I were not going to Japan. there are probably many months worth of downtown content to be had before that quest can be called anything like done. Thanks very much for asking your questions, for enjoying the game, for talking to your friends about it, even if you're not quite sure how to describe this madness to another human being. And I will see you next time.